Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. How much technology can one city take? That's the question journalist and author David Talbot poses in San Francisco Magazine. And as you can imagine, the piece has received a flurry of responses. Talbot reports that San Francisco is currently home to more than 1,700 tech firms, employing 44,000 workers, up a whopping 30% from just 2 years ago. And San Francisco has been the nation's top magnet for venture capital funding for 3 years in a row. The distinction between Silicon Valley and San Francisco has all but disappeared, he writes. It is us and we are it. But Talbot argues that because of rising rents and city workers being squeezed out of the city, there is trouble in paradise. He asks, do we wish to be a city of enlightenment or a city of apps? If you live in an area dotted with high-tech companies, how are you sharing the same space, and how has your city changed? Has your city prospered economically, and for whom? David Talbot founded the pioneering online publication Salon.com in 1995, so this is nothing new to him. His latest book is called Season of the Witch, which recounts the gripping story of San Francisco during the turbulent phase between 1967 and 1982. And you can find his latest San Francisco Magazine piece at yourcallradio.org. And David joins us in studio. Hi, David. Nice to see you.
Hi, Rose.
Thanks for coming in. So your story has received such a huge response, both positive and negative. And the main question you ask is, how much tech can one city take? A lot of us have been talking a little bit about this, but what kind of got you to finally say, all right, I really have to write about this. We have to have this conversation.
Well, I think it's living in the city myself. I've lived here now for, since 1980. Raised two kids here who both went to public schools. I started a business here, as you mentioned, Salon.com, one of the first online publications. So I went through the first dot-com boom back in the 90s, and I saw the impact it had on the city, this amazing progressive capital of the Western world, San Francisco, that was a beacon for freaks and dreamers and innovators and the edgy. And I saw the kind of impact this new wealth, this really kind of gold rush type wealth was having on the city. And look, San Francisco's always been a gold rush town, literally, since the very beginning, back in the 1840s. And so we're used to these kinds of huge swings in wealth, these booms and busts, but it does have a wrenching impact on the city, and particularly, I think, on San Francisco's sense of itself as a progressive city that's open to all kinds of people and all classes of people and all races. And that's being increasingly challenged as, frankly, San Francisco becomes less and less livable for most people.
Well, and for people who don't live in the city, what changes have you seen? What's different about this boom?
Well, I think there's more wealth with this boom. You know, the first boom tended to be, I think, a little ephemeral. You know, not many of those companies had staying power, but we're looking at bigger amounts of capital now, more jobs, more of an impact on the workforce here. And along with that comes sort of the whole ethos of the tech world, which is, has contributed many great things, obviously, to our daily lives in terms of just think of what the web has done for us in terms of, taken the kind of human consciousness to a much higher level and human learning. But on the other hand, you know, it's a very driven and ambitious and selfish in some ways culture, a deep libertarian streak. Mm-hmm. I got mine, you know, why don't you get yours kind of attitude. You know, if you're suffering, if you're out of work, why not have an IPO? I mean, there is a kind of, I think, that kind of tech blinders exists out there. And it's not really a consciousness that's very community-based, as opposed to some of the earlier invasions, I think, that did take place in San Francisco. The hippie, invasion in the 1960s, the gay invasion in the 70s and 80s, those were very much about solidarity and about social struggle together.
And so in addition to a lot of the Silicon Valley companies that are setting up shop here, I know that in the last couple of years, I've heard people say, I'm tired of living in Silicon Valley. There's not much to do. I want to live in San Francisco. And so they put the pressure on companies like Yahoo and Google to open these offices in San Francisco.
That's right.
And it's happened so quickly.
And yet there's little understanding of why San Francisco is so attractive to these young people. The generations of struggle that went into making this such a cool, you know, oasis. And I write about that in my book, Season of the Witch, of course. That took years of labor struggle, of bloodshed, of militant unionism, like the Longshoremen's Union under Harry Bridges and other very progressive and militant leaders. It took people fighting and dying, literally, to make San Francisco open and fun and creative. And, you know, literally riots in the streets, political assassinations, you name it. San Francisco endured it, you know, particularly in the years that I write about in Season of Witch from 67 to 82. But now there's a sense that this new class of, you know, people coming in, you know, are a little oblivious to that and are just enjoying the fruits of that struggle without understanding that, you know, that you have to put some blood, sweat, and tears into this town.
Hmm. It's also, in addition to tech companies, you've got a lot of biotech companies moving in.
Absolutely. You know, but again, it's that elite, you know, kind of workforce that's moving in with, you know, disposable incomes. They can afford to go to these great restaurants. The restaurants are booming. That is one good, you know, aspect.
And again, to let people know who don't live here, in the Mission District, it's unbelievable. It seems like every week there's a new upscale restaurant. And we're talking upscale, $20, $25 a plate, beautiful design and architecture, new chocolate shops opening up. I mean, people who live there, I walked behind a guy the other night and he said, another one, another one. I can't keep up with this.
Exactly. No, we're being swarmed by the bridge and tunnel crowd. I live right near the Mission. My kids grew up there. You know, they have friends they went to public school with who are Latino families, working class families. They're still struggling to hang on in the Mission, but it's increasingly difficult, of course, as the rents skyrocket. But you see, you know, still two and three families sort of squeezed into some of these fire trap buildings in the Mission alongside these, you know, five-star restaurants that cost, as you say, $100 a plate or $100 a person. There's one restaurant that now is serving $500 meals in the Mission. You know, this is an extremely high-end place. So, you know, you saw a little, you know, spasm of reaction to that, of course, with the Occupy riots that, you know, broke out a few months ago, people trashing the windows in the Mission. I mean, there is a sense now of sort of class anger, I think, about this, particularly among young people who come to the city trying to pursue their dreams or have lived here for years, their families, and are now finding them squeezed out.
We're speaking with David Talbot about a piece that is running in San Francisco Magazine. It's getting a lot of response. And I want to give out the number early because you said a number of things here, and I'd love to hear a listener's response. David says it's a sort of selfish culture, a deep libertarian streak. The conscious that is coming to San Francisco is not community-based. A lot of these young people are oblivious to the struggles that came before them. What are your thoughts about this? If you live in San Francisco, and if you don't live in San Francisco, what are your thoughts about the changes? And so many areas, Palo Alto, Mountain View, and the East Bay is being affected by this tech boom. In Santa Cruz, what are you seeing down there? How are tech companies changing what you're seeing on a regular basis? How is your city changing? And who's really benefiting from this prosperity? The toll-free number is 866. You're listening to a rebroadcast of Your Call, so unfortunately, we can't take any of your phone calls. Please tune in live tomorrow at 10 a.m. What do you think of David's arguments? You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. How is this changing the look of San Francisco? Because we talked about this a bit before the show, just about the race.
Absolutely. Well, it's definitely changing the coloration of this city. I mean, San Francisco already had a problem with the declining African-American population, more and more African-American families being that sort of peaked in the post-war years. African-Americans were brought to San Francisco to work on the docks and work in the defense industries. But a lot of those middle-class, blue-collar families, as the economy changed, were being pushed out of the city. But this, I think, has now accelerated that process. It's increasingly difficult for blue-collar families, particularly black and Latino families, to hang on, except as service workers in this new tech economy. And, you know, how did they afford to live here as the cost of living skyrockets? So it's changing. I mean, when you look at the workforces, as I've done, and I ran my own company here in San Francisco, and I'm very familiar with what they look like when you go into these workplaces at Twitter and so on, Zynga, they're white and Asian. And that's the city itself becoming more and more white and Asian. Well, what is the future for Latino, young Latinos growing up here and African-American kids? If, you know, there isn't aren't affirmative action programs, if there aren't worker training programs for these young people coming up. And, you know, by and large, as I say, there's a libertarian consciousness within this tech sector that prevents these companies from thinking about that kind of thing, because they basically think, look, you know, we want to be race and colorblind. And, you know, if you've got it, you've got it. If you don't, you don't. And they don't want to really be seen as, you know, making, I think, racial concessions or social concessions that would challenge that libertarian ethic.
And the city is actively involved in this. Let's talk just for a minute about Twitter. Last April, in an 8-3 vote, the San Francisco Board of Supervisors approved an ordinance to give Twitter and other tech companies an exemption from having to pay a 1.5% city payroll tax for the next 6 years, as long as they move to the city's Central Market and Tenderloin areas, which is known for its sort of gritty aspect. Frankly, if you're homeless, you can be homeless there. In a lot of other places, it's very hard to be homeless. Can you talk about that tax break and how significant that was?
Absolutely. The mid-market is Dave Eggers, who's trying to, we can talk about this, create his own project there, the local writer and cultural entrepreneur. The mid-market, in some ways, is the sort of the future of San Francisco. Whether the mid-market goes, the city goes, because it's the last sort of key central space in San Francisco. And you're right. It, right now, it's kind of like an overflow from the Tenderloin. It feels like the Tenderloin when you walk the streets. A lot of homeless people on the streets. There's a real scruffy kind of aspect to it. And yet Twitter has established its headquarters there. They're literally up in the clouds. They're up on the 10th and 11th floor. They have all their needs provided for them, these sumptuous lunches that are they're you know, provided the workforce there. They're actually shuttled in on private shuttles, so they never even have to ride on muni buses if they don't want to. They're very cocooned. And so they talk about, because I think there's obviously a lot of decent and wonderful people who work at these companies who do want to give back to the city and are involved in the city, but these companies don't necessarily encourage that, other than saying, you know, bringing in a few people at lunchtime to talk about their charitable projects and so on. You know, they're not fully integrated into life for the city.
Well, and also the argument was, if we don't give them this tax break, they're going to go somewhere else.
Well, that's exactly. So the city...
Do you believe that?
Well, look, I believe that actually the tax structure needed to be corrected, because the current tax structure was penalizing job growth by putting taxes on a number of employees you have. And now it's being shifted to revenues. I think that is actually a smart move on the part of Ed Lee, the mayor. But, you know, there is a whole kind of culture now of concession from City Hall to the tech sector, a sense that he's going to them on bended knee, the mayor, and saying, what else do you need? What can I do for you? He has these things called Tech Tuesdays, where he goes into these companies, you know, Autodesk and Zendesk and Twitter and Zynga, and each Tuesday, and says, what do you need? What can the city do for you? He told me, as he says in the article, asking for something in return. He's asking these countries to contribute the way that the great benefactors of the city in the past have done, like Warren Hellman and the Haas family and the Shorensteins and so on. But, you know, he's making it a voluntary kind of thing. And not all these people, of course, have that kind of social consciousness.
And also, again, what role do you think your government should play in attracting tech companies to your city? And how do you feel about these kinds of tax breaks? We've got full lines. A lot of people want to weigh in on this. So let's hear from Christopher in San Francisco. Hi, Christopher.
Hi, Rose. It's Christopher Cook. I'm a local writer and journalist, and actually worked at the Bay Guardian in the early 2000s when we had the earlier sort of tech-related boom and then bust, and the sort of economic monocropping, as we called it, of the city back then. And I'm really glad you wrote this article, and I just see it in the Mission where I live all the time, this sort of flood of money and privilege that comes in, and we're seeing along 24th Street now, which was kind of seen as the last bastion of non-gentrification in the Mission District, and it's now getting completely overrun. And I guess what I wanted to bring up is the issue that you were just talking about planning and government. And, you know, what we've seen in the past is a very, pro-tax break, sort of pro-big business government approach. And I'm just wondering if you've investigated or could talk about other approaches to both city planning and development policy that might encourage, that might discourage gentrification, that might encourage much more retention of folks who already live here and more of a balance.
All right, thank you. You know, we'll get to that in a minute. I just want to free up a few lines so others can call in. Let's go through a few callers. Let's hear from George in San Francisco. Hi, George. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Jesse. I wanted to agree with your guest, and what I was also going to add is that there is no sense of community. I mean, as a community, people should be connected to each other's life experiences and sense of suffering, and there's like this, I mean, the city is very balkanized now, and you have this, as your guest mentioned, these folks that work in these tech companies, which is great, but they are so self-involved, I think, and what does this do for the, I mean, for the city as a whole, and it becomes an industrial city at some point, and there is no sense of we're all in this thing together.
Well, and George, where do you get that from? Do you have any connections with tech workers?
I used to work in the tech world at one point, and I'm not in that world anymore, but I'm having conversations and people, and I'm talking to some people in some of these neighborhoods, and they literally, I mean, they sometimes even think that if somebody in Noe Valley thinks the person who lives down in some parts of Mission, they won't go there because it's not safe, or and people don't have this sense of that this is all one city, one community, and it's kind of these, there's these imaginary gates or fences that this is our part of town, that's theirs. And that's because even, I mean, the comment about Jack Dorsey saying, I take the Muni. So what? I mean, why not?
Well, thank you for calling, George. We'll get a comment in just a minute. Let's hear from Harry in San Francisco. Hi, Harry. Welcome to the show.
Yes, good morning. First of all, I wanted to point out your guest, I think, is confusing the change in the payroll tax with the stock options indemnification that was given to Twitter and others. And Twitter now has its own bus. Just as the museums were able to get their own bus, which, like the Twitter bus, was partially full but cost $7, unlike the Twitter bus. And I think it's just shameful the way wealthy people were able to control this city. There's a great documentary by Adam Curtis that everyone should watch. You can see it on Vimeo called All Watched Over by Machines of Loving Grace, and it talks about libertarianism and Silicon Valley. And what I see here in San Francisco is a lot of nonprofits that work on behalf of the wealthy, such as the Parks Alliance and the San Francisco Botanical Garden Society, commandeering public space and trying to clean it up. And there's a real there's been a decade-long war against the homeless, and certainly that's a part of it. In what's going on in mid-market there on 6th Street, they've been trying for decades to get rid of homeless. I don't know where they think the homeless should go. Maybe they'd like to construct mass graves and...
Well, they're not going to go anywhere because so many cities across the country are sending homeless people to San Francisco. So this is going to be an issue that the city is going to have to deal with. Thank you, Harry. We'll take a few more calls and then we'll get a response. Let's hear from Tia in San Francisco, or Thea in San Francisco. Hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's Thea in San Francisco. First of all, let me say, David, I just read Season of the Witch, and I'm running for office as we speak, and it certainly did open up my eyes. But the reason I'm calling you right now is that I am a small business person, and I have a business on Market and Mason, and we have been kicked out of the floor that we've been on for 10 years. I feel like we've been holding down mid-market with our 7 employees and many, many other small businesses like us, because there's this whole speculation. I absolutely agree with you. We are a boom-bust town, and the realtors very much encouraged by the mayor are going to double and triple the rents on my floor, and they're going to have a high-tech company go in there. So I am very much against this. I think the small businesses are the backbone of San Francisco, everything from the mom and pops to the services. I do marketing for magazines mostly, and I really would like to see small businesses get the due, get their due because they are really the people who consistently, through the boom and the bust, employ people.
And so, Sophia, like, have you left the building already?
We are in the process of leaving the building. They have us in a temporary spot on the sixth floor as they raise the eighth floor, and then we're looking for another space.
And what are you hearing?
And we may leave the city. We may have to leave the city.
What are you hearing from others in the area? Because I'm hearing that a lot of those groceries, those corner stores that are open really late, that they're also going to see their rents triple.
Yeah, I mean, I'm also the Lower Haight Merchant and Neighbor Association president. I started it 5 years ago, and we are seeing rents through the roof. I saw 40% in your article, David. We're seeing 100 to 200% on the commercial side.
Wow.
And even on the rental side, I think you know that if there's an empty space, a one bedroom can be $2,500 to $3,500.
Yeah, particularly in that area, it's become a real boom area.
Which is crazy. So,
well, thank you for calling in, Thea.
Yeah. No. Look, you hear these complaints from more and more people. I write about a number of them in my article in San Francisco Magazine. These families who are just really holding on by the tips of their fingers in the city. And look, Ed Lee pointed the way, I think, to the solution. Not as mayor, though, when he was a young activist. Let's remember that Ed Lee, long ago, started off his public career after graduating from law school as a rough and tumble street activist who was fighting evictions in Chinatown. And he fought against big corporate landlords. He fought against speculators. He fought against a lot of the, yuppie lawyers that he'd gone to school with, law school with. But now he found himself on the opposite side in the courtroom. He was a tough, militant activist. He called what he was doing class struggle at the time. And that's what it is. And San Francisco has a long, rich history of that. As I said, going back to the labor days, Harry Bridges and the militant Longshoremen's Union that did so much for the city. Because when you declare a limit to what greed can do, you open up an oasis of humanity in a city. And that's what San Francisco has stood for years. We need a new wave of that kind of community militant activism to say, look, these are the limits of greed in this town. You can have so much, but not all of it. And, it takes people like the Occupy movement. It takes community groups. It takes housing groups to really draw the line and say, you know what? San Francisco stands for more than just IPOs and overnight wealth.
We're speaking with David Talbot about his new piece in San Francisco Magazine, How Much Tech Can One City Take? He asks the question, do we wish to be a city of enlightenment or a city of apps? And we've heard from a lot of people in San Francisco. We'd also like to hear from those of you who live in other places like Emeryville, Menlo Park, San Jose, Santa Cruz. How is this issue affecting your area? Are you seeing a tech boom there? How are you sharing the same space? How is your city changing? And what role do you think your government should play in trying to bring in these new tech companies to keep employment at decent levels, at least? The toll-free number is... This is a pre-taped Your Call, so unfortunately, we cannot take any of your phone calls. How do these companies moving in change the city and also change the culture of the city? You can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. I'm Rose Aguilar. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling...
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Your Call, so unfortunately we can't take any of your phone calls. Please tune in live tomorrow at 10 a.m.
.org, where you'll also find links related to today's show, and that's where you can sign up for the show's weekly email newsletter. Just click on the email newsletter link on the right side of the page.
Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are speaking with David Talbot. He founded the pioneering online publication Salon back in 1995, before the internet was even a household name. His latest book is called Season of the Witch, which recounts the gripping story of San Francisco during the turbulent phase between 1967 and 1982. And he's out with a piece that has received quite a lot of attention in San Francisco Magazine called How Much Tech Can One City Take? And he writes about how San Francisco is changing drastically because of this new tech boom. 44,000 workers are employed by 1,700 tech workers. That is an increase of 30% in just 2 years. And we'd love to hear from you. If you live in San Francisco, we'd love to hear from you. But also, if you live in other parts of the area, Emeryville, San Jose, Santa Cruz, what does this look like in your area? And when we're talking about bringing tech companies in, what role do you think the government should play? How is your area changing? And who's really benefiting from this prosperity? This is a pre-taped Your Call, so unfortunately, we cannot take any of your phone calls. YourCallRadio.org or post a comment to yourcallradio.org. And let's hear next from, I wanted you to answer Chris's question. He said, what other approaches should a city take when it comes to planning and development to make sure that sort of, we're all in this together and it's not just benefiting the few?
Well, I think to give Ed Lee's administration credit, he is doing something. He is taking some of the steps that are necessary. They're just insufficient. He needs to do more. One was written about in the Chronicle today, the housing trust fund that the city is proposing. It's put on the November ballot, and this would establish a significant fund to help middle class, not poor families, but middle class families buy homes in San Francisco. That's a worthy step. There's a similar program for public school teachers because the city became so concerned about public school teachers being priced out of the city and having to commute miles and miles just to teach our city's children. Again, these are the right steps, but too little. We need to go further in helping to subsidize, frankly, the middle class in San Francisco so they stay here. We also need to, frankly, unions are the last bastion, I think, of a decent society in many ways. And the Hotel and Restaurant Workers Union is one of the last strong unions in San Francisco. That union represents the service class. These are the people making the beds, washing the floors, picking up the trash and serving food to the tech elite and the rest of us in the city. And, you know, we need, when those unions take a stand for decent wages and for decent working conditions, we need to support them. That, again, is one of the last bastions of a decent, progressive San Francisco. Unions are important, community groups. It's not just City Hall. We all need to work together to push the city forward.
Why do you think people in other areas should care about what's happening here? Do you think that what the mayor is doing is being looked at by other government leaders?
Oh, absolutely.
Like Santa Cruz, for example, in that area.
Absolutely. San Francisco, because of its size, because of its prominence, has always been, I think, a beacon, an incubator, a kind of weather vane for the country, for progressive ideas, whether it's, curbside recycling, gay marriage, medical marijuana, again and again, the kind of creative ideas that first seem shocking and ridiculous even to the rest of the country spread, but they often start here in San Francisco. So San Francisco as a progressive capital is a very important notion to this country. If we didn't have San Francisco being the bleeding edge, not just in technology, but also in social ideas, I think it would be a great loss to the rest of the country.
Well, we've got a number of callers on the line. Let's go back to them. Let's hear from Kate in San Francisco. Hi, Kate. Welcome to the show.
Hi, I think you mean Kay.
Oh, hi. Sorry about that. Hi, Kay.
I'm a native here, and I've also been very active in labor for many years, like 40 or 50. And part of the problem here is the labor movement has shrunk, and what is left is not too educated in terms of real fight backs. But the culprit is the dot-com. This second wave is a killer when it comes to rent. The people that quoted prices, I've been looking at rents for 10 years and trying to find a place, and it's affected, of course, the peninsula as well, but the people that quoted prices are quoting low, because I look every day on Craigslist. It's over the moon. $3,000 to $5,000 a month for rentals in San Francisco, and the peninsula is following suit, and it's creeping over to the East Bay. So it's affected the whole Bay Area. It is, under capitalism, whatever the market will bear. And until people fight back, like a rent strike, this is going to continue. Part of this tech thing, the infiltration of tech companies and jobs, the higher wages, has allowed the real estate field to do what they want to do. And a lot of this in San Francisco, there's a lot of hidden real estate speculation. We used to have the landlord who owned one small piece of property. Now we have big management companies taking over. I'm a native. I am just appalled at what's happening. We're being overdeveloped. The green space is shrinking, and I heard Harry talk about what's happening with some of the public green space, and I would suggest people get involved in the Green Party or a movement to protect that in the city. But it's going to take a lot of people and good organization to change this, unless we can find legislation to do the job. And, you know, under capitalism, excuse me, we don't allow for a planned economy. This is like the wrong kind of growth. And when people talk about this as progress, I have to sit there and, you know, rage, because it isn't. I am like a senior. I'm getting tired of this. I was part of the civil rights, you know, all along. And it's like we never have been able to sit there and say, oh, this, I can retire now. We really can't. You know, a lot of people are still working in their 70s. So.
Well, thank you for calling in, Kay, and to rents. We have a few emails about that. Butler writes in, not far from my home is a $559,000 sale pending. One large room with amenities behind panel doors along the side and a divider to make sort of a one bedroom, maybe 600 to 700 square feet, one parking spot. Is this the future of San Francisco?
Well, I think unfortunately it is, at least for the near future. And look, this has come home for me. I've mentioned this in other situations, but I have a niece who recently graduated from UC Davis. She's an engineer, a civil engineer. She went to work as an intern for the city. She couldn't afford to find any place. She looked all over the city. She looked at, you know, a number of living situations where she'd be crashing in a closet converted to a bedroom. And so she's ended up living with my wife and me in our home in Bernal Heights, where our two sons, our grown sons, are also living. So, you know, for young people, it's particularly hard unless you're, you know, you've got an elite tech salary to afford to live in the city. And so, again, if you care about the San Francisco and about its future, and you want, look, the young people are its lifeblood. The young people are the people who create the future, literally, right? And San Francisco is always dependent on young, freaky, innovative, you know, hustling kids to come in and, you know, make the city vibrant. And if we're losing those people more and more to the East Bay and to other cities, you know, Oakland's much more interesting in many ways to my kids now than San Francisco itself. You know, you see the kind of a street vibrancy in Oakland that you don't in San Francisco. And in part, you know, it's because the tech companies aren't setting up shop in Oakland for various reasons we can talk about. In some ways, that's spared Oakland. I mean, it may not help it economically, but it's spared Oakland some of the problems we're seeing here in San Francisco.
All right. Well, thank you again for calling, Kay. Let's hear from Victoria in Palo Alto. Hi, Victoria. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you. I just want to say, you know, I'm 63, sort of semi-retired, and recently I've seen younger friends who are having to leave the area because they've jacked up the rents. And another aspect that I've looked into is I'd love to put a granny flat or an accessory dwelling unit on my property. I have a 5,000-square-foot lot. Unfortunately, the city of Palo Alto will not let me unless my lot's 9,000 square feet. If I lived in Santa Cruz, I could do this. I don't know if people are aware that there's a state law or mandate that is supposed to allow single-family homeowners in all municipalities in the state of California to build these ADUs or granny units, but then they changed the law to make it compliant with each city's laws. So I feel that this is an untapped resource. I mean, people like me who would like to retire but don't want to leave the area and want to help out younger people who want to live here, I think this is an option that needs to be explored.
Yeah, it's a good point. And you're right, that is a way that public policy in Palo Alto could be changed to benefit everybody. And I agree, more and more, it's like my situation, my home, more and more young people need to crash with us older people who do have a little extra space in our homes.
We're speaking with David Talbot about his latest piece in San Francisco Magazine, How Much Tech Can One City Take? How much tech can your city take? And how is tech affecting your city? Who's benefiting from this new prosperity? And how do you think the government should interact with these companies? The toll-free number is 866-79. You're listening to a rebroadcast of Your Call, so unfortunately, we can't take any of your phone calls. Please tune in live tomorrow at 10 a.m. Or talk about the changes you're seeing. Give us a call at 866. This is a pre-taped Your Call, so unfortunately, we cannot take any of your phone calls. Because it's happening, so how should it be dealt with? You can also leave a comment, yourcallradio.org, or email feedback at yourcallradio.org. And let's go next to Cherry in Oakland. Hi, Cherry. Welcome to the show.
Hi, it's Cherry in Oakland.
Hi, Cherry.
Hi. So I unfortunately agree with almost everything people have said. I think the tax breaks that have been given to these billion-dollar companies have resulted in an additional financial assault on the middle class. There are now proposals parking tickets in San Francisco are probably the highest in the state. And there are now proposals to have parking regulations and restrictions on Sunday. So then it happens that the middle class ends up paying flat taxes in the nature of parking fees well in excess of anything that these high-tech companies will contribute. I read something last week in the paper that one of the companies had given $1 million to as a donation to a nonprofit in the Bayview, which I assume is cheaper than what they would have to pay to the city in revenues on any kind of a payroll tax. And I think the impact of the policies initiated under Ed Lee, that is to gentrify or bring these corporations to the city, is having an extremely negative impact on the middle class, on the tax basis, and on the quality of life for the city. And one more observation, the proposal now to create these mini living units of 100 or 200 square feet really generates this horror in my mind of something like Hong Kong, not the disparage Hong Kong, but to have these units where people who basically serve the tech industry can live in these hovels to provide whatever services they need. And the emerging picture of San Francisco catering to companies that the catering bringing no benefit to the city whatsoever except a clean corridor on Sixth Street is very distressing.
That's a really good point about the quality of life that the city is, proposing or envisioning for these young tech workers. I mean, these small units, these closets that, they'll be squeezed into, like Hong Kong or the salarymen in Japan. I mean, what kind of, talking about communal or social life, can you expect if you're squeezed into that kind of living space?
220 square feet.
Absolutely. And people work already ungodly hours in these for these tech companies. That's what you see, these huge, I call them death stars that like glide through, the neighborhoods, Noe Valley and Bernal Heights, picking up people and taking them down 101, these huge tour buses to Google and other companies. And, they do that so they can be working constantly, even during their commute hours, their Wi-Fi buses, so there you see them on their laptops. They're working all the time. Again, that has an impact on the social life of a city if the workforce is being worked around the clock. And, they're given all these great comforts, but the comforts allow them to stay in those companies working all the time, so you don't see these people on the streets. To me, it is a nightmarish vision. It's a kind of dystopian vision of the kind of city we want or don't want to live in.
Well, thank you for calling, Sherry. And let's hear next from Ellie in San Francisco. Hi, Ellie. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. And I agree with a lot of the calls. I'm calling sort of to speak on two points. One, coming from somebody who's worked as a waitress in San Francisco and also as a community organizer in the Silicon Valley. So kind of seeing this effect from those two angles. as a community organizer, is working on environmental and housing issues. And to your question about who's benefiting from this boom, I think that the cities of the Silicon Valley are really benefiting without having to pay a lot of the costs. One of the things that we constantly pushed against were cities that were not interested in increasing the housing supply in places that are really jobs rich. So the Palo Altos and Mountain Views of the world, they're seeing a lot of the financial benefits of having companies that bring in an incredible amount of revenue to city coffers, and they're not interested in changing the number of homes and the sort of feeling of the city overall, for the, they'd like to keep it as it is, which has an impact on San Francisco. Without allowing sort of new, exciting places to develop in these cities near jobs where many young people work, and maybe they'd like to live close to those jobs, it means that young people who want those things are looking to San Francisco. They're not interested in living in sort of more suburban, quieter places down on the peninsula. So San Francisco is paying the price for cities further south to get to enjoy the financial benefits of these companies being located there.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. Look, we're talking really what it comes down to is redistribution of the wealth. I mean, you know, the Republicans, the Mitt Romneys of the world who, you know, control too much of the wealth hate when we bring that term up, of course. But that's what we're talking about, not only in terms of the city coffers, but the corporate coffers as well. And you want a city that's a city of two, a tale of two cities, where there's a cocooned elite at the top, and then you have the sort of scruffy street life below that gets harder and harder for average people to take. I mean, we need to have new policies that redistribute that affluence. And, you know, even little things like the caller brought up earlier, parking tickets. I mean, that is a regressive tax that's been put on the middle class and the working people of San Francisco. Even in my neighborhood in Bernal Heights recently, you know, the meter maids were coming through my block and ticketing cars that were like maybe a couple inches too far from the curb. I mean, that obviously is, you know, kind of the parking department gone mad, trying to meet its quota and, you know, ticketing people. And they're expensive tickets, as the caller said. They're becoming more and more expensive. So it's that kind of sort of daily grievance and daily gouging that, you know, is happening more and more in San Francisco and other cities in the Bay Area that working families just can't take anymore.
Well, and I'd love to ask, we have just about 6 minutes left. If you're waiting on the line, what changes would you like to see from your government? How should they deal with this issue? And thank you for calling in, Ellie. Let's go next to Rylan in Santa Cruz. Hi, welcome to the show.
Hi. I'm just wondering if you guys could address something that is kind of the elephant in the room as far as urban issues are concerned, and that's state and federal policies and how they affect cities like San Francisco. And that's basically my call, is just kind of...
And Rylan, can I ask, is this tech boom affecting Santa Cruz? And if so, how?
You know, it's rent is still, it's high in Santa Cruz, but it's not ridiculously high. I'm 26 and I'm living at home, and it's not San Francisco yet, but it is getting there. So,
all right, thank you.
I'm sorry. So the question was, I didn't get it.
How is Rylan still there? He didn't.
Rylan.
Because I asked him that second question, I also lost his question.
Yeah, maybe he'll call back again.
I'm sorry, Rylan. We both did that. So we'll come up with his question. Let's hear from Eric in San Francisco. Hi, Eric. Hello, Eric.
Not being mentioned why housing costs so much in San Francisco, and that's because of the urban zoning and planning departments in San Francisco. They're terribly mismanaged. The laws are antiquated. It takes over a year, like a year and a half, to get a building permit in San Francisco. The Aaron Peskin and his army of no-sayers have prevented all kinds of development south of Market and in the Mission area, because under San Francisco law, you have to have that approved by the Board of Supervisors, and they always reject these because they don't include enough free housing. So it's basically the system itself.
Well, look, I think the system you bring up, Aaron Peskin, who's been a gadfly, a progressive gadfly in this San Francisco city life for a number of years. I think the problem with the San Francisco sort of forces of progressivism is they're too balkanized. People used that word earlier. Progressive forces in housing and labor and throughout San Francisco city life need to come together and coalesce around candidates, need to coalesce around issues, and not speak with so many different voices and not be seen as kind of just always complaining and being contentious, but actually put an affirmative plan before the city for how the city's, what's great about San Francisco to be preserved. But if progressives are seen as just holding on to their, special little, neighborhoods, their little gems, that won't be, I think, a winning strategy. San Francisco needs to coalesce around issues like housing, like public schools. And I think if we had a dynamic, candidates for the Board of Supervisors and the mayor's office, we could really take the city forward. But San Francisco, frankly, has been suffering from a dearth of great progressive leadership, I think, for some years now.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. And we've got a number of emails. I just want to read. Marie writes, my daughter's a kindergarten teacher in public school in the Mission with many low-income families. As a renter, she has a husband and two young children. The building they live in was sold recently and they have to move. They have not been able to find a rental they can afford in less desirable neighborhoods. Her husband is the creator of a nonprofit that serves the children of the communities. Lower income community involved residents cannot afford the city anymore. Restaurants are also out of reach.
That's right. So we're losing, in other words, the progressive crusaders who have fought to make this city livable. I mean, that again is a loss that San Francisco can't afford to have. These are the people, the citizens who take it upon themselves to get lower wages, to live more simply in order to make life better for the rest of us. And if they can't afford to live here, then we're really in trouble.
And we have a few other emails. Isn't what you're talking about a local form of the global race to the bottom? I've thought that the way to stem the downward trajectory was to find the bottom, to put a fair floor on that bottom, and to build up from there. But that would take cooperation across all cities. Is such a thing impossible?
Well, you're right. I mean, in a way, San Francisco is just a little ship floating on this global sea, and it's global capitalism. These forces are having effects all around the world, and look what's happening in Europe now with young people in the streets in Spain and Greece and so on. So these ranching kind of global multinational forces are being felt everywhere. And San Francisco is no different in that way. So we do need, I think, both not just a local strategy, but a national strategy and even an international strategy as well.
And that was Celine in Capitola. Thanks for writing in, Celine. We have just a couple more minutes. Let's hear from Joan in San Francisco. Hi, Joan.
Is that Joanne?
Oh, hi, Joanne.
Yeah. Hi, I've lived in San Francisco for over 30 years, and I couldn't buy a place here at first because it was too expensive. I bought a place in Oakland, and then when I could afford it, I moved back. But I'm feeling a real sense of entitlement about people who've lived here for a long time as opposed to people who move in. I mean, who do you think is buying the meals and paying for them to support the people who are cooking and serving? When I go on Valencia Street, I see all these restaurants and bars that are open and hopping, and people are spending money. This is what we need in San Francisco. And just because they're young slacker types who are riding their bikes instead of driving doesn't mean that they're any less than a working class person who's like the cop on my beat. He lives in Pleasanton. He doesn't live here. And that's what's happening in San Francisco. It's young, wealthy people and people who are poor. That's the balkanization, if you want to call it that, or the split in, it's the haves and the have-nots.
Well, thank you. We didn't even get to talk really about what's going on underground in San Francisco, the poverty that a lot of people are not seeing. I mean, they're seeing homeless people on the streets, but they're not seeing a lot of the poverty.
That's right. That's invisible to a lot of this new wealth. But you're right. San Francisco still has a terrible homeless problem. And, families that are, would love to actually, have some of the problems that we've been talking about today that are beneath the poverty level in the city. And again, this is the responsibility of all of us. We need to have a city where the struggling poor can live and we help them and not just sort of buying their street sheets as we go into our restaurants. But that the city itself have a policy to take care of that. I mean, we've struggled that for years through one, you know, administration after the next in City Hall, and San Francisco's never been able to get its arms around the homeless problem. And that's, you know, a deep scar on the soul of the city.
We have about a minute left. What reaction are you receiving from decision makers to this piece?
You know, a dead silence from decision makers. It's people like who've been calling in, who I've been hearing from, everyday people who are forced to, like, deal with these problems. But I haven't heard from the City Hall. I haven't heard from, you know, progressive leaders even. I haven't heard anything like that. So that's you know, speaks for itself too, right? Where are the sort of, like, where's the ferment of ideas? It's within leadership circles about this.
And what would you say to people who want to do something about this and then people listening saying, I don't want this happening to my town?
Look, we've got to organize. It's organize, organize, organize. Find a way to join hands with others in your community, in your workplace, wherever you are, to improve life in San Francisco. And we've talked about a number of ways we can do this, in public education and housing are two of the most important ways, I think, job training. And, you know, we've got to do this together. But it's time that San Francisco rose up again. We have that great tradition in the city. It's time to, you know, rediscover that.
David Talbot is founder of the pioneering online publication Salon in 1995. His latest book is called Season of the Witch, which is next on my list. And his piece is in San Francisco Magazine, How Much Tech Can a City Take? Thank you so much, David.
Thank you, Rose.
And thank you for your phone calls and emails. Thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call, and here's what's coming up tomorrow.
Could the U.S. stop using oil and coal by 2050? While President Obama talks about an all-of-the-above energy strategy, physicist and environmentalist Amory Lovins says we can end our dependence on oil and coal without passing legislation in Washington. On the next Your Call, hear Amory Lovins' plan and find out what it would mean for you. Can technology and market-based solutions get us off the dirtiest fossil fuels? It's Your Call with me, Matt Martin, and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.